On this week's program, the White House applying pressure to clean up the Panther Island boondoggle in Fort Worth. Also, a shining example of what progressive governance looks like in Central Texas. And one Texas congressman fighting back against Democrat efforts to impeach the president. In our interview, we talk with former Solicitor General Jonathan Mitchell about a very intriguing lawsuit he's filed to stop the city of Austin from funneling taxpayer funds to abortion. And we'll close with a commentary from Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan. Welcome, Patriots, to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Now, let's get started with this week's top news. I wanted to go up to Robert Montoya in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Robert, you've been doing a lot of work covering this story related to the Panther Island scandal in Fort Worth. Now we're learning that the White House is applying pressure, trying to clean the scandal up a bit. Tell us what's going on.
Yes, Tony. So not only has the, since coming to power, has the Trump administration cut off federal funding to the Panther Island boondoggle, but sources are also now telling us that the White House is also demanding the termination of Congresswoman Kay Granger's son, J.D. Granger, as well as Jim Oliver of the Tarrant Regional Water District, is pushing for them both to be terminated and removed from the project.
Yeah, now we'll talk a little bit about those guys in a minute, but for people who maybe aren't familiar with this project, let's talk a little bit about what it is. I've joked, I've called it a few times on the program, Kay Granger's Floating Island. but it is really truly this almost fantasy project in Fort Worth. Tell people what it is that they've been saying that they were trying to do.
So a while ago, before 2003, Fort Worth realized that with their massive growth of population, they've got to update their flood control systems. So instead of going for one option that was presented to them, which was much more affordable and wouldn't take as long and be less disconcerting, inconvenient to individuals, they decided to go for the other option, which is far more expensive and essentially seeks to recreate the San Antonio Riverwalk in downtown Fort Worth by redirecting our Trinity River. And this idea came into conception in 2003, and after about 16 years, a programmatic review found that no phase of construction has been completed at all, in spite of burning over $380 million of taxpayer money.
And that's really important, because the initial estimates had this thing at what, $400 million as an overall estimate. They've blown way past that, spent almost the entire estimated amount, and they haven't done anything.
Yes, and under Granger's watch, now the estimates for finishing this project have blown to beyond $1.1 billion, and they were supposed to be done a while ago, and now the completion date has been pushed back to beyond 2024, as I understand it.
Yeah, so huge boondoggle there. Let's talk a little bit about this character Granger and some of the things that you've uncovered. You've done a few articles about him and, you know, what he was doing, how he got this gig.
Yeah, so recently we obtained a copy of Granger's resume, and what it revealed was that before taking on Panther Island, he had no experience managing any kind of project of this size and scope ever before. I mean, the only work experience he had before this, according to his resume, was he worked in the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office right after graduating, getting his law degree.
Okay, so the guy's a lawyer, works in the DA's office, gets the job. Why? Because, you know, undoubtedly, because he's the congressman's son. Look, the project's been a boondoggle. It's a huge failure at this point. But what about these guys involved? There's been some allegations of misbehavior.
Yeah, so this programmatic review done by Riveron, it found that members of the Trinity River Vision Authority, the board of it, they were complaining about how Granger and Jim Oliver, who's the executive director of the Trinity River Water District, had colluded together and kept the board in the dark about decisions they were making. So there's been almost no accountability with how this project's been managed at all, and keeping people out of the loop.
Now, obviously, with the White House holding off federal funds and coming in and demanding that these guys be run off, that could be some accountability. Do we actually expect that will happen?
Well, sources in Tarrant County have told us that they expect the city of Fort Worth to begin the process of terminating Granger. But we're also hearing from critics that, you know, it could be that all that happens is they just change Granger's title and that's it, and he really won't be removed at all. They'll just, like, give him some different name, and he'll still be involved.
Yeah, shuffle the deck a little bit. Well, folks, if they're interested, particularly people in Tarrant County, taxpayers there, if they're interested in some accountability on this project, definitely need to be talking to their local elected officials and demanding accountability. Thanks for your reporting on it, Robert.
Thank you, Tony.
Speaking of bad behavior by local government officials, let's turn our focus to Travis County and talk with Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau. Jacob, when you and I talk about things that go on in Travis County and Austin, it's really the shining example of what Democrat governance looks like and what it might look like if Democrats were to take charge, take power in the state of Texas. And it's really very bad news for taxpayers.
Oh, absolutely, Tony. And the summary of this story is higher taxes for you, higher salaries for your local government officials. Travis County Commissioners Court just voted to raise taxes by 8%. And they also voted to raise their own salaries, hoarding nearly $16,000 just this year. And now get this, Tony. They already have another planned pay increase next year. So assuming they approve that, they'll have raised their own salaries nearly $50,000 in just 3 years.
Yeah, so how much are these guys going to be making as government officials?
About 150 grand.
Yeah, so they're going to be making 150 grand at the same time raising taxes on their constituents. Tell us, how much are they raising taxes and how are they justifying that?
Yeah, so the average county homeowner is going to be paying about $126 more just next year. And why are the commissioners taking that money? Well, they are responding to the state government who just passed property tax reform. And what this reform does is it says if a local government like the Travis County Commissioners want to raise taxes more than 3.5% in a year, they simply have to ask citizens first. And the commissioners don't like that. So they're taking as much money as they can now before that reform takes effect next year.
Yeah, and they're describing this like it's an impending crisis. Our voters are going to have more say on tax increases, and so there's going to be, you know, they're going to say no, so lean times ahead. So we've got to stockpile tax increases now, but obviously it's not so much of a crisis that they can't pay themselves more.
Right. Commissioner Jeff Trevelyan even said that we're responding to terrible public policy, and so we're having to do uncomfortable things.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Apparently, a $16,000 raise is pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, so they know that this is going to hurt taxpayers.
Absolutely. Commissioner Margaret Gomez even said that she's heard from taxpayers in the county saying, look, we're going to have to leave Travis County if the taxes keep going up. And the commissioner actually said, quote, we'll just face the heat on this because we want to do progressive things in Travis County.
So there it is. That's what progressive things look like. If you're interested in progressive government, that means higher taxes and higher salaries for your government officials, all on the same day.
All in a day's work, Tony.
Finally, let's turn our focus to Washington, D.C. and talk with Kerry Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. The Democrats doing all kind of machinations to try to impeach President Trump. And we're seeing at least one Republican congressman from Texas do a little bit to fight back. Tell us about kind of what's going on there and what this one congressman's doing.
Well, that's absolutely right, Tony. So to kind of sum everything up, because I think a lot of people are confused about what's going on in Congress, is, of course, we saw Democrats lead a witch hunt against President Trump for the first half of his term, saying that he colluded with Russia. They had the big Mueller report come out and said, hey, we have no evidence of that.
Total dud for them.
Total dud. And so what you're seeing now is you're seeing President Trump, Attorney General Bill Barr, starting to peel back the onion, find out about the deep state investigation of him, that, you know, they had the Russian collusion aspirations. They had the CIA spying on him during his campaign. And in the process of that investigation, he's being thwarted by Democrats who are now after him for all sorts of other issues.
Yeah, specifically, he's out there investigating Hunter Biden and these corrupt contracts that were going on in Ukraine, and they have, you know, said, oh, well, you can't investigate this guy who's connected with your political opponent. even if there really is something there.
Right. Hunter Biden, who is making $50,000 a month for this Ukrainian kind of state-funded organization to basically just be the vice president's son. And then when there's people in Ukraine investigating that, Biden goes over there and gets the prosecutor fired, and they have this whole investigation and everything.
Well, yeah, well, Trump asking about this stuff, that's enough. That's an impeachable offense to the
absolutely.
Democrats.
Absolutely. So Trump was asking, hey, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. He was talking with the Ukrainian prime minister. Can we find out about this? He says, hey, we're happy to help, you know, corroborate. You've got this CIA whistleblower saying there's quid pro quo allegations. They release a transcript of the recording. None of that's there. But really, to get back down to brass tacks, you have Democrats trying to thwart the duly elected president and stop him from being able to enact any of his agenda by just gumming up the works of Congress with impeachment. And you're seeing finally some Republicans start to fight back. I know you've seen House Freedom Caucus members out in the media defending the president and stuff, but here you're seeing a Texas representative, Lance Gooden from East Texas, actually come in and say, hey, I want to remove Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, for improper conduct in this whole impeachment proceedings, because we haven't decided to have an impeachment proceeding, and you've decided we're going to have one. That's not up to you to decide. Yeah, that's up to the House to decide.
Yeah, you basically have these partisan political operatives on the Democrat side out there trying to gum up the works, engage in an investigation. None of this stuff, Gooden's pointing out, I guess, is none of this stuff's been authorized.
Right, absolutely. It's hey, if we're going to actually have impeachment proceedings, if we're going to have a real investigation, we have to vote to do that. And look, Democrats have the majority. They can actually do that, but they haven't so far.
Yeah, and they're basically
afraid to do it.
Yeah, they're afraid to actually take that.
So what they want to do is they want to continue litigating this war in the media and gumming up the works of Congress. And you've got Lance Gooden coming in and saying, no, look, hey, if you want to actually impeach the president, we're willing to fight you on that battlefield and defeat you on that battlefield. But if you're not, quit playing these games, and let's get back to doing the people's business. Because you're seeing, as we mentioned, the works of Congress get gummed up. President Trump is able to confirm judges in the Senate. There's able to do a whole lot of deregulation with his cabinet secretaries doing great work. But you're not seeing the big monumental bills move through Congress because everything's about impeachment now.
Yeah, that's what everything's going on. What do we think may happen? How will this play out?
So that's a great question, Tony. So, of course, Congress is on recess right now. They're going to come back pretty soon. I actually think that AOC and her mob will demand that they do impeach the president, and they'll move forward on proceedings on that, and we'll waste taxpayers' time for the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to see. Are any Republicans going to step up to fight back? That's the real question.
Hopefully more will join Lance Gooden in doing so, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome on the show this week Jonathan Mitchell, principal of Mitchell Law PLLC. You're one of those guys from the legal community, I would say one of the really smart guys. Used to clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, Solicitor General of Texas for 5 years. Lots of experience in the law, and you have a really cutting-edge case that I wanted to talk about.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So I was going through the news, and we've covered this a little bit on the program. Former Austin City Councilman Don Zimmerman suing the city of Austin over its new policy to try to divert taxpayer funds to abortion services in an indirect way. And there's this lawsuit filed. I read the lawsuit, and I'm going, these are some really interesting arguments that are being made. I need to get with the lawyer who filed this. And so here we are. Let's talk a little bit about this case. What's going on in the city of Austin? And then we'll dive in. I think the really interesting thing are the arguments that are being made.
Sure. Well, a little bit of background. The state legislature last session passed a statute called Senate Bill 22, and it outlaws any taxpayer assistance provided by local governments to abortion providers or to the affiliates of abortion providers. And the city of Austin was clever and tried to get around the statute by providing taxpayer money, not to the abortion providers directly, but to these so-called abortion assistance organizations that provide logistical support to women who are trying to abort their pregnancies. So these are organizations that may provide travel to or from an abortion clinic or child care services or abortion doulas, things like that. And these entities, these abortion assistance organizations, don't fall within the statutory prohibition in Senate Bill 22.
Yeah, and so they're putting the money to these folks, but y'all are saying, hey, this is against the law, longstanding laws.
Well, the thing is interesting. It doesn't violate the text of Senate Bill 22 because the city of Austin's correct on this point. The statute was written in a way only to cover the abortion providers and their affiliates. But it does violate another statute that is still on the books in Texas, which is the pre-Roe against Wade law that criminalizes abortion and that also criminalizes acts that aid or abet abortions. So one of the early statutory provisions that was enacted back in 1854 imposes criminal liability on someone who provides the means for an abortion, knowing the purpose intended. And the city of Austin's taxpayer expenditure is in violation of that statutory provision, which has never been repealed. Now, people may say, well, didn't the Supreme Court declare that statute unconstitutional back in Roe against Wade? And the answer is yes. The Supreme Court did opine in Roe that the statute's unconstitutional. But that doesn't formally revoke or erase the statute from the law books. The statute continues to exist as the law of Texas, and it can still be enforced as long as you do it in situations that doesn't contradict what the Supreme Court has previously said about the status of abortion as a constitutional right. And one thing the Supreme Court's been very clear about in the abortion cases is that there is no constitutional right to taxpayer funding or taxpayer subsidies of an abortion. So the state's not permitted under Roe against Wade to impose obstacles or to impose what the Supreme Court says is an undue burden on a person who's seeking an abortion, but there's no constitutional requirement at all that they provide taxpayer support to a person who has made the decision to abort the pregnancy.
Well, so this is a really interesting inflection point here where, you know, it's interesting. We have this law in the books, and people think about it and say, oh, well, the court said that law was unconstitutional, as if, you know, poof, the law went away. But it's still there. It's still on the books. It makes it illegal to put funds towards procuring an abortion. And the court has said, hey, you don't have a right to funds from taxpayers for an abortion. So it, you know, looking at the law and looking at the court precedent, you would think this argument would work. It's very interesting.
Yeah, so the problem we're having, Tony, is that people have a tendency to think that when the Supreme Court declares a statute unconstitutional, that the statute has somehow been formally revoked or erased. But that's not at all how judicial review works. The Supreme Court has no veto power over legislation. It has no ability to delete a statute from the law books.
And in fact, that's something the founders, I mean, that was something was debated and rejected.
That's right. This was actually discussed at the Constitutional Convention because James Madison especially wanted the judiciary to have a veto power. He wanted them to actually partake in the same veto prerogative that the executive had. And he proposed something that he called a council of revision that would consist of judges as well as members of the executive branch that would together exercise the veto as a collective body. And the convention rejected this proposal. But Madison pushed hard for this. He actually proposed it on three separate occasions. All three times it was voted down. But this was a proposal that was considered. What the judiciary does have is the power of judicial review, not the power to veto. But people too often think that judicial review is akin to the executive veto power because we use rhetoric such as struck down or strike down. Whenever the Supreme Court has declared a statute unconstitutional, the newspapers will say the statute's been rendered void or it's been invalidated.
In fact, the judges sometimes, I mean, judges do this, lawyers do, I mean, we can't just blame the newspapers. I mean, it's everybody speaks in terms of this terminology, but it's not exactly accurate.
Not at all accurate, and it actually reinforces unconstitutional understandings of what the judicial power is. So I always encourage people, to the extent possible, just to avoid saying that. Just never say struck down when you're referring to a court decision that's dealing with the constitutionality of a statute, and don't let your friends use that phrase either. You know, I wouldn't go so far as to correct your professors in the middle of class if they use that terminology. I wouldn't do that because they may think I put you up to it and I could get in trouble. But at the very least, maybe if you have someone who's using that in class, you could at least stop by their office during office hours and just say, I'm really trying to avoid the bit of erasure fallacy in my own thinking, and your use of this terminology is a stumbling block to me.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit. People don't even know what Roe v. Wade was, but I mean, this is a case, right, against a district attorney saying, hey, you can't prosecute women who go to get an abortion. You know, it's in that context that that case came about, and you have a ruling on that. So I guess it doesn't even matter whether the court were to overrule Roe v. Wade or reaffirm it. It hasn't ruled on this particular element. In this particular
I think it actually has ruled on this particular element with respect to taxpayer funding.
Right.
And the court's made abundantly clear that there is nothing in the Constitution that requires taxpayer funding of the abortion procedure or any kind of taxpayer subsidy to someone who's seeking an abortion. So someone who's trying to enforce the Texas abortion laws against the city of Austin in this particular context won't be facing any constitutional barrier from Roe against Wade or any decision of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and so what would you say? I mean, there are critics of this, obviously, who would say, no, that law, it hasn't been enforced in 50 years. The court's ruled against it. This is no longer a valid law. It's been, the state has moved on from that law. What's the response to that kind of argument?
The response is the state hasn't repealed the statute, and until the state repeals the statute, it continues to exist as the law of Texas. Now, you're right to say the statute hasn't been enforced since 1973, but that's because any possible enforcement of the statute prior to the city of Austin's decision to provide taxpayer subsidies to abortion assistance organizations would have violated the Supreme Court's edicts in Roe against Wade. What makes the Austin situation unique is this is the first time that a subdivision of the state of Texas has tried to offer taxpayer subsidies for abortion. And that is the one thing we know from the Supreme Court that is not constitutionally protected when it comes to the constitutional right to have an abortion. So this is an area now where Austin has provided an opportunity for these statutes to be enforced once again, at least in this particular situation.
Yeah, and so where are we at? So Zimmerman files this lawsuit. This is filed in state district court, correct?
Right.
And tell us kind of where does it go from here?
It was filed in state district court on September 11th, the day after Austin enacted its budget on September 10th. And we'll have to wait to see how the city responds to this. I expect they'll probably move to dismiss or file a plea to the jurisdiction. We may move for a temporary injunction. But the disputes between the plaintiff and the city will all concern questions of law. There really shouldn't be any disagreement over the facts. The budget is a matter of public record.
Right.
We know what the city of Austin's doing. So we're hoping we can get a ruling quickly on the legal issues and then take it up on appeal if needed.
Now, and we're very notoriously, this is in Travis County, so we have a largely Democrat-elected judiciary here. One would presume and expect kind of negative treatment at the trial court. So this, if assuming that that happens, and obviously you can't guess at this point, but assuming that were to happen, that's then going to go up. So this is something that would eventually get to, I guess, the Texas Supreme Court, and then maybe to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Possibly. It's really a state law question, although there is a federal constitutional issue that the city might try to raise as a defense. If they try to say that we can't enforce the state abortion laws because it contradicts something in the federal constitution, if Austin makes that argument, then that could present a federal issue that could trigger jurisdiction in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, and so that would be after you go up to the Court of Appeals, go to the Texas Supreme Court, and then it would be eventually possibly going up to the U.S. Supreme Court as well.
Right. But, of course, that's many years away, and we also don't know what the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court will be at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's kind of looking at it and guessing. But, again, it doesn't exactly matter whether you have a majority there that would rule in favor of Roe v. Wade to kind of reaffirm that decision in a general sense. This is a very different question dealing with the nature of judicial review and law, and it's a very interesting one.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing in the claims that we're making has anything to do with the correctness of Roe against Wade as a constitutional decision. The case is about the nature of judicial review. And do the courts actually revoke or somehow veto or erase statutes when they declare them unconstitutional? And there's a tendency for people to think that that is what happens, but it's not. It's not at all what judicial power is. No.
I think it's very interesting. I, like I said, I was going through and reading through the case, and I said, this is, you know, getting at some really heart of the heart about judicial review and what we expect courts to do and separation of powers and those things. Very, very interesting stuff. Now, I'm running out of time. Tell folks who are interested in this, they need to connect with you or your client or wanted to learn more about the lawsuit, how can they get in touch with you?
Sure. Well, to learn more about the lawsuit, the complaint should be available on the internet if you just look for Zimmerman against the city of Austin. The writ of erasure fallacy is the notion we've been discussing on the air today about the tendency to think that judicial review is somehow akin to a veto. And this is explained in a law review article I wrote a couple years ago in the Virginia Law Review. So if you just look for the writ of erasure fallacy online, that's another document that explains the thinking behind the lawsuit. And if you want to get in touch with me to discuss any of those issues, my email is Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, at Mitchell.law, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L.L-A-W.
Very good. Well, thank you for coming on and explaining it to us, and keep up the good work. Very interesting lawsuit, and we'll definitely keep an eye on it to see what happens with the city of Austin. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Your state lawmaker probably campaigned as a conservative, as someone who would go to Austin to cut spending and limit government. But did he keep that promise? At index.empowertexans.com, you can see how your lawmaker voted on the major issues of the legislative session. Things like property tax relief, the state budget, and regulatory reform. You can also view his score on the Fiscal Responsibility Index and decide if he needs a pat on the back, a wag of the finger, or perhaps a permanent vacation from public service. The Fiscal Responsibility Index is the premier tool for taxpayers to hold their lawmakers accountable. Check us out today at index.empowertexans.com.
To whom should elected officials be loyal? Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan touches on that in this week's commentary.
With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. It's in the Gospel of Matthew where we find Jesus' wise admonition that, quote, no one can serve two masters, end quote. Practical experience shows us that no matter how hard we try, it's always true. And it's especially true in politics. I find very few instances in which someone ran for office for the sake of being corrupt. Nah, corruption happens over time as elected officials start seeking the approval of lobbyists and their fellow elected officials rather than the voters for whom they work. It happens when they worship the master of governing power rather than serve the citizens. Not a day goes by, it seems, which I don't hear a legislator tell me they have to do such and such, or more often cannot do that thing because they have to work with these people. Those people, of course, being their fellow lawmakers. They don't want to upset the legislative apple cart or disrupt the congeniality of the process or risk being unpopular in Austin or Washington or wherever. Remember, Texas legislative session runs for just 140 days out of 730 days, and lawmakers are actively working with other lawmakers for even less time than that. Definitionally, none of the other members of their chamber can vote for them. Yet, for many of them, being loved and respected by their fellow lawmakers is far more important than keeping the promises they made to their actual constituents, to the people they allegedly serve. Politicians cannot seek both your approval and the approval of the political establishment. The tension of even trying will always result in the citizens losing precious liberties at the altar of contrived congeniality and the religion of self-promotion. For our system of government to work, for liberty to be preserved, politicians must remember they are the servants of the citizens. We must expect them to serve the citizens first and only. And the citizens should remember that as well. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's show. If you did, go on and subscribe to the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.